Hello, and welcome to this week's Ukraine Calling program. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, bringing you a roundup of the weekly news, culture, and some music. Later in the show, we'll bring you a feature interview with Diane Francis, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council, Editor-at-Large at Canada's National Post, award-winning columnist, best-selling author, investigative journalist, and TV commentator. Well worth listening to. But first, as always, the news. Well, in Kyiv, Ukraine's parliament reconvened after its summer break on the 6th of September. It has a full agenda. Key legislation needs to be adopted in judicial reform, healthcare, pensions, as well as changes to improve the foreign investment climate and more. The following day, President Poroshenko appeared before the chamber with his annual address. His key message was, Ukraine is set to become a successful country of successful citizens. He cited the latest Freedom House report that says that populists and autocrats are the greatest threats to democracy in the world. Well, the names Saakashvili and Tymoshenko certainly were in the news this week. Two politicians, who are often accused of populism, were all over the Ukrainian and international headlines. Former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili illegally crossed into Ukraine via the Polish border on the 10th of September. He was with controversial former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Saakashvili has served as Odessa regional head at President Poroshenko's invitation until he quit last November, complaining of corruption. Poroshenko then stripped him of Ukrainian citizenship, which he had been granted. At the beginning of the new political season in Ukraine, Saakashvili forced his way back into Ukraine with the help of his followers. He was welcomed in Lviv by the city's mayor, Andriy Sadovy, leader of the Samopomich party. Yulia Tymoshenko, who accompanied Saakashvili, is now also in open opposition to President Poroshenko, and speculation has been fueled about whether a broader anti-Poroshenko coalition will now be formed. In Crimea, Artem Chigoz, the deputy leader of the Mezhlis, the executive representative body for Crimean Tatars, was sentenced to 8 years behind bars. He was found guilty of, quote, organizing mass disturbances, unquote, between pro-Ukrainian and pro-Russian forces on the 26th of February 2014. Our listeners may remember that that day heavily armed, unmarked troops stormed the Crimean parliament and took it over by force. At the time, Crimea was still formerly Ukrainian territory, and the troops, the so-called Green Men, were from Russia. Two people were killed during the scuffle when Crimean Tatars and other Crimeans attempted to prevent the violent takeover. Amnesty International has called this trial by the Russian-controlled Crimean Supreme Court a sham and condemned the ruling. They reported that according to eyewitness accounts and video footage, Chigoz had attempted to keep the crowds apart to prevent violence. He had been kept in pre-trial detention for 13 months, was not allowed to attend the court session for sentencing, nor communicate with his lawyer in person. And the war in the east continues. The ceasefire on the front line between Ukrainian army and pro-Russian forces continued to be unstable. Low-intensity fights continued over the last week. The OSCE Special Monitoring Mission issued a report on the 13th of September in which it said that for 2 days violence had significantly reduced. In total, over the last week, 2 Ukrainian servicemen were killed and 11 wounded. Meanwhile, the international community continues a debate about the possibility of sending a UN peacekeeping mission to the Donbas, how large it should be, who would lead the mission, and where the peacekeepers would actually be deployed. All are questions that remain unresolved. The deputy head of Ukraine's presidential administration, Konstantin Yeliseyev, told journalists on the 9th of September that even after these questions are answered, it would take at least 6 months for any peacekeeping mission to be deployed. And important new European conventions have been signed by Ukraine. Justice Minister Pavlo Petrenko was in Strasbourg this week, where he signed 2 European conventions. Ukraine is now a signatory to the Council of Europe Convention Against Trafficking in Human Organs and the Council of Europe Convention on Offences Relating to Cultural Property. The second convention is the only international treaty that specifically criminalizes the illicit trafficking of cultural property. Now they need to go through the ratification process. Well, I'm very honored to have a very special guest here, a very distinguished journalist, author, academic, public figure in Canada and the United States. This is Diane Francis. She's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, but among other things, she is an award-winning author. She is the editor-at-large of Canada's National Post, writes for the Huffington Post, is a star on Al Jazeera, etc., etc. Anyway, so my first comment is welcome, Diane, to Hromadske Radio's program, Ukraine Calling.
Very happy to be here.
And I want to ask you, you've achieved so much. When I look at your CV and the list of publications, the obvious question is, why is Ukraine so important to you? Why have you come here so often? Why do you write, for instance, for the Atlantic Council so often on Ukraine?
Well, I think it's interesting because I came from the United States originally at 19 as a bride from the United States with a British husband. We went to Canada because it was Vietnam War and he did not want to go in the U.S. Army, to be blunt. So he wasn't quite a draft dodger, but he was British, but they were drafting immigrants. So we came there and I had really not known that much about Ukraine or its culture. But, you know, Canada's Ukrainian diaspora is enormous. And so I made lots of friends, and lots of my friends were Ukrainian. And I had a housekeeper for many years who helped me raise my children. She was Ukrainian. So I got very engaged in the stories, the culture, loved the music, loved the food, loved the people. And I would guess, really, that they came in three waves to Canada. They're still arriving in Canada from Ukraine, Ukrainians. I would guess that probably 10% of the population of Canada is either fully Ukrainian, half Ukrainian, or married to one. That's, you know, 3.5 million people. That's the biggest diaspora, apart from Russia, of Ukrainians. So as a journalist and running a national newspaper, you always look for audiences and you look for stories that your audiences are interested in. And so the minute that the Soviet Union dissolved, the first place I went, I had a trip with a photographer for 10 weeks. My newspaper sent me all over the Soviet Union. First place I went was the first week was Ukraine. And I went to Ukraine because I had friends who could speak and get me introductions and help me with it. And I adopted it journalistically. Why? Because there's a huge appetite for Ukrainian news in Canada just because of the size of the diaspora.
But Diane, even so, you know, you're an expert on energy security, global business and economics, technology, and you've written so much books, not just articles. How have you found the time to keep up with events?
Well, I guess you call me an autodidact. I just absorb information. I'm a junkie. I need to know. I do really well at Trivial Pursuit, the board game, where you have to have a lot of useless information at your fingertips. It's just sort of my nature. I've always been like that. So thank goodness I became a journalist, because that combined with a nosiness and a gossipy nature, it's the perfect skill set to do what I do. And so it's not a job. It is my lifestyle. It is a personality disorder, if you like. I'm always snooping and asking and analyzing. And so it's just natural that I do all this work.
Amazing. Anyway, such a good example for all of us. But let me ask you now, what brings you to Ukraine this time around?
Well, this time around, I've come with friends and also a small delegation from Atlantic Council, where I've been attached for about 3 years, and a Ukrainian friend. And I'm also now investing in Ukraine. I have a partnership in a small software development company. We're developing a software tool here because, you know, I think what I've found as a journalist, and I've covered the IT industry in Ukraine, I was one of the first to write about how explosive and dynamic and world-class it is. And so I've gotten to know a lot of the players in the IT sector. And so I came up with an idea for a software development tool, and we're doing it here. We've got a small team, and we're going to raise more money, and we're going to have a big team, and we're going to do something that I think might really change things worldwide. And, you know, this is a country that has a lot of brains, because I didn't realize, it took me many years to understand, that this was the Silicon Valley of the Soviet Union. The space program, aerospace, sciences, weaponry, all of that stuff was principally developed by Ukrainians in Ukraine, or sometimes they relocated to Russia. But this was the Silicon Valley. So it's not a big leap for them to have gotten involved in the tech development, which is exploding right now all over the world. And that's another one of my passions, Silicon Valley.
Right. That's a very interesting observation. Thank you for pointing that out to us and to our listeners. But you've just been in Lviv at the opening of a brand new, very modern library at the Ukrainian Catholic University, the Sheptytsky Library. Any impressions you want to share with us on that?
Well, UKU is something that is very important to friends of mine in the diaspora, and a lot of them were there. It was like old home week. A lot of Canadians were at the cocktail party, the dinner banquet, the celebration, the wonderful religious service. And I met the bishop for the first time, and he really is one of the founders, and he really is an impressive fellow. And so
Boris Gudyak, Bishop Boris.
Yes, exactly. Very impressive fellow, and a fellow American. So we kind of connected on a number of levels right away. It was a great experience, and I'm trying to set up a joint venture project between UKU and Ryerson University in Toronto, which I'm affiliated with. I'm not an academic, but they call me a professor. I lecture there. And we're trying to set up a incubator, a technology partnership. And we're exploring how we can do that. So I've been talking to the UKU people, and I've been talking to the Ryerson people, and both the presidents of the two universities want to collaborate. So we're going to do something interesting there. And then if we do that, we'll take that template and maybe go to Kyiv Polytechnic and try and spread it around.
And the library itself, impressive?
Library is magnificent. I think Banish, the architect from Germany, did a wonderful job. He really gets it. The building is interesting and multi-purpose. And as, you know, the reality is, as the library becomes less and less, the libraries of physical books on bookshelves becomes less and less important, this can be repurposed, and they're planning to repurpose it. Libraries are going to become virtual and accessible by computer. So you're going to see this library with a lot of screens, a lot of meeting rooms, and repurposed perhaps into a computer science incubator.
Right. And Lviv itself, you like?
I love that city.
Great.
I could live there.
Look, let's move on and at least share with our listeners some of your thoughts that you've recently expressed in your most recent articles for the Atlantic Council. I see that your very latest publication is called How Famine Shaped Modern Ukraine and Russia. And I presume it's a review of Anne Applebaum's new book.
Her new book, Red Famine. And I think she did a terrific job. I'm a fan of hers, and she really does understand, of course, the region. And her body of work shows that. This book is good because, yes, we all know about the famine. And a friend of mine, Ian Yanatovich, did a very good movie called Bitter Harvest about the famine. So there's a lot of concern that people understand that this was a political genocidal act, one of the worst stains in history, and it was perpetrated by Stalin and the communists. And so what she does, though, is she just doesn't go over the same old ground, but what she does is she is able to extrapolate what the famine did to shape the current attitudes of Ukrainians and Russians. And that's what I found intriguing about her book. And I think she's a good person to be able to have done this. Basically, there's the victimization and the attitude on the part of Ukrainians, which is valid, of course. But there is this superior patriarchal almost attitude of the Russians toward Ukrainians. And it's a little deeper than that, but I think the book is very good.
Okay. And before that, something very, very pertinent, topical, especially as you were in Lviv. I happened to be at the same time, and we both saw Saakashvili's arrival after the controversial crossing of the border. I won't comment on that myself, but your article before the one on the famine was entitled "How Healthy is Ukrainian Democracy?" So how healthy is it, in your view, in the light of the most recent developments?
Well, I think Ukraine is transitioning, and I'm an optimist by nature, and I think this country would and can become the most dynamic, biggest country in Europe. But people are voting here with their feet. Some people believe that the census hasn't been taken for a long time. There's fewer than 40 million people now living in Ukraine, and we see them popping up in the United States and Australia, certainly in Europe.
Portugal, Italy.
I understand that there's something in the order of 125,000 Ukrainian students studying in Warsaw alone. It is enormous, and this is ruinous. The corruption has to be addressed and fixed. A lot of people say, well, it's in the DNA. It is not in the DNA. I grew up in a city called Chicago, which was notoriously corrupt. When I was a child, my father would be stopped by a policeman in the car for speeding when he wasn't speeding and have to give him $10 bribe to be able to proceed. Judges were crooked. Politicians were crooked.
Mayor Daley.
Absolutely.
Untouchables of their day.
And we grew up in that. And I'm sure, I mean, my father wasn't in business, but I'm sure businessmen had to pay extortion money. I know they did. There were big scandals to the fire, the building inspector, the police. And this went on until some major investigative pieces were done in a newspaper.
So what lessons can we draw from that? I'm very glad that you brought up that.
The lessons to draw from that is simply this. People, the transparency about these situations have to be openly discussed and known. And I think that's the case already in Ukraine. However, you have to have judges who will put people in jail and police who will investigate it. Now, we have Nabuu here, and they're investigating, and they've made two very high-profile arrests. But nobody believes that even if those people are found guilty, that they will ever pay a punishment. Because the judges are all crooks here.
Well, we don't.
And that's very upsetting.
We have this attempt to overhaul the legal system to create an independent judiciary,
yes.
But we're still a long way from it being achieved.
Well, you have 8,000 judges and you have 15,000 prosecutors, and all of those people have to be dismissed, and all new people who are vetted properly, who are of the same moral compass. You see, this is not about just being good versus bad. The most important infrastructure, if I can use that term, the most important architecture to build a healthy economy and therefore a healthy society. Because if an economy is rich and producing taxes, you can fix things in society, can look after the less fortunate. You can't do that without the rule of law. There's no rules, then only the thugs win. Only the people that are corrupt, who bribe people, only the people that threaten people, only the people that lie to people, those people succeed. So you end up with an economy full of those kinds of people running it and preventing other people from enterprise. And so, you know, the same situation also existed in the United States during the robber baron era, the late 19th century, and Rockefeller and all these people. Well, they had the rule of law, and the president stared down these people and said, you will break up your empires. That has to happen here. You can't have 10 people, 10 oligarchs, running an entire economy, and they run just about every sector. So if somebody wants to come in like Ryanair, Kolomoisky vetoes it. Because he controls the airport and he controls the political system. And so Ukrainians, therefore, are deprived of more jobs because they would have hired people, a $20 airfare to Paris, and now they're paying $200 to Mr. Kolomoisky or whoever else is involved in it. That is not a healthy economy. That is not necessarily corruption, but in the United States, it is illegal for a monopoly to exist like that and keep out other people. And that's a good thing. And so antitrust activity, anti-monopolies, Europe is doing it. The United States did it first. And the reason why the United States surpassed Britain in economic power during the Industrial Revolution in 1880, 1890, and then at the turn of the century, because they broke up the oligarchs. They broke up Rockefeller. And what happened to Rockefeller? His biggest, he had 90% control over the world's oil industry. He had to break up his company into five or six pieces, and he could only own one of them. He did that because that was the law. And Rockefeller went on to be a very good guy, philanthropic. And the family is very, you know, there's two Rockefellers sitting in the U.S. Congress. They're admired. And so that's what you have to do. You don't get rid of the oligarchs. You get rid of the practices.
Well, I just want to remind listeners that I'm talking to Diane Francis. She's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, the editor-at-large at Canada's National Post, and a very distinguished figure in the world of journalism, public and publishing. Diane, but you point out all the shortcomings and the huge tasks that remain to be done. And yet, as you said, and I sense your optimism.
Totally optimistic.
Is it the... Where do you see the sort of the generation of that optimism? Is it coming from the younger generation, from the changes that already are underway, the momentum that has been started, the revolution of dignity? What is it that fires you with this passion and belief in Ukraine?
Well, the IT industry is, of course, the leading edge for all of this. And they are unscathed in terms of corruption because they're dealing with Western clients. They sign contracts in the West, and they're paid in the U.S. currency. And so they're not being leaned on or taken over by some of these forces. They're not being forced and extorted at this point, because they're offshore. I would say that this is the way I put it. Every young Ukrainian who had the gumption to say, I'm going to immigrate, is an entrepreneurial act. They're entrepreneurs. They voted with their feet. They're studying in Paris or Poland or wherever they're going. They're working in kitchens in Toronto. They're doing what they need to do. I went to an UKU graduation this summer, graduation ceremony, and most of the kids that graduated in computer science couldn't attend their own graduation. They'd already been placed. That's tragic. You fix Ukraine, a lot of them come back. There is a natural entrepreneurial spirit in the human beings, but you have to guide it and make sure. For instance, I would even say the oligarchs here, they're very talented business people. But let's make them do it properly. Let's make them break up their empires and grow them and let other people in to compete, and everybody gets smarter and better. So there is a huge amount of talent and entrepreneurship in the Ukrainian, I think, personality. And so I see it. There are going to be, before long, some companies that are going to be started, software companies. I'm involved in one. We're going to come up with things that are going to rock the world and maybe turn into gigantic corporations.
Well, let's hope so. And thank you for giving us this optimism, which I think is quite often lacking. There's sometimes a spirit of despondency that things aren't happening fast enough.
It grinds you down.
Yes, it grinds you down, especially if you live here. But, okay, finally, because we're running out of time, Dan, looking in from the outside, what could Ukrainians, whether at the level of the government or civil society or the media, do to be better understood, to acquire more support in the context of hybrid warfare, disinformation, fake news, etc.? Do you think that Ukrainians generally do a good enough job in the challenging situation that we are in?
I think the journalists are very courageous in Ukraine. And there's freedom of speech, freedom to assemble. I mean, this is not Poland of 20 years ago, and this certainly isn't Russia. It's a hybrid media situation. One of the first reforms you have to do and should have been done a long time ago is make all of the oligarchs divest their ownership in the media. You cannot have the media It's okay to have a free media, but it's not free if it's connected to the power base, either the political power base or the business power base. So that has to happen. They have to be unfettered and independent. Doesn't mean they can't be owned by business people, but they can't be owned by politicians, in my opinion. That is a very important thing. But within that context, there are some really terrific journalists in this country who fight for it. Facebook is utilized very nicely. The Maidan, because of Facebook. You've got a lot of the reformers that are in the RADA now are ex-journalists, investigative, Leshenko and Nayim. And so, you know, this is an important, I see this spirit. And what young people have to do is they have to get involved in civil society organizations. They have to get involved in NGO organizations, not necessarily getting paid by them, but helping them raise money, raise awareness. They have to start to run for political office or help people that are willing to do that run for political office. And they have to speak out to the extent they can. And that's a little difficult for everybody, any walk of life, against corruption.
Okay, now to finally, I traditionally ask my guest on their any final messages that you want to pass on to our listeners about Ukraine, about where it's going, though you've been very clear about how you see its potential. But if there was one message that you wanted to convey, what would it be?
I would say be optimistic, but work for earning that optimism. You have to work toward it. And if you can't change the system, I encourage you to immigrate. You shouldn't spend a life in a system that grinds you down. So get out, go, or start your own business in Ukraine, or get into an IT business or a related industry where you don't get ground down by it. There's a lot of people that aren't in IT who are great businessmen in this country, and they're doing a good job. And so you've got to do those things.
Thank you, Diane, for this, I would say, very fresh, refreshing new look at and approach in that message, because very few people dare to say that openly, to express the options that remain. I've been talking to Diane Francis, a celebrated author, journalist, a leading figure in that sphere in North America, and as you've now gathered, a very good friend of Ukraine's. Thank you for this interview.
You're welcome.
And now, culture. Well, when September arrives in Ukraine, it brings with it a rich harvest of cultural festivals. For those in search of the new, the VDNKH grounds in Kyiv are host to a week-long multidisciplinary contemporary art festival, Gogol Fest. Gogol Fest is theater and dance, opera, circus, visual art and cinema, and performance art. It presents many new projects, which are innovative and unusual for a Ukrainian audience, definitely the largest contemporary art event in Ukraine. Chernivtsi hosted its famous poetry festival this week called Meridian Chernivtsi. The three-day event features Ukraine's best-known poets and writers and international guests. Hot on its tail comes the much-awaited Lviv Publishers Forum, which is a popular book fair now in its 24th year. It attracts large crowds, not just eager to snap up the newest books, but also to listen to their favorite writers speaking. And in Mariupol, in the southeast, the acting capital of Donetsk Oblast, while the city of Donetsk remains under the control of anti-Ukrainian forces, there was the music festival Chervona Ruta. Musicians from all regions of Ukraine gathered from the 6th to the 10th of September to perform and compete in Ukraine's oldest musical festival. Now, moving on to music. This week's song comes to you from the Mariupol Chervona Ruta Festival. It's by a band called Royal Kit. They won the runner-up prize in the rock music category for their Dai Mi Spokoi, which means something along the lines of give it a rest. The Hutsul twang is interesting since the band is not from the Carpathian Mountains but central Ukraine. So enjoy. Dai Mi Spokoi, Hurt Royal Kit, Krivi Rih, Dnipropetrovska Oblast.
Я був би сліпше горівки, напевно. всему, що з тобою. Штерик. Нині зрані коло хати стало трохи шумно. Штири курки сі побили за одного півня. Качка сварить сі на гуску без на свого хвоста. Дай ми спокій з того худоба, не стаємо ми злости. Маю файного колегу, звати його Михайло. Кожен день, коли приходить, сі ховаю в стайню. То попросить кусник сала, то стакан горілки. Дай ми спокій з тим колегом, не відкрию фіртки.
Ой, дай ми.
Кисі протерли отакі дири. А коли вікно сі дивлю, іде Маруся. Аж під жилками сі труся, як отого вуся. Ті дівчата такі горді, страшно сі дивити. Дай ми спокій з кавалерку, треба сі женити.
Ой, дай ми.
Бурячину і відро лупині. Дайте спокій з тими свині. Дай жити, скотина. А як вечором заграють файні музиканти, там всі хочуть танцювати, що нема де стати. Ті госпідниці всі крутять і шапки літають. Дай ми спокій з танцюванням, дай ми заспівають.
Ой, дай ми спокій, ой, дай ми.
I'm looking forward. Ukraine Calling will be back next week with a new show for you. Feel free to announce your idea if you have one. And to join our mailing list, please write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org or just write and let us know what you think. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio. Thanks so much for listening.